This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. For more than 20 years, he's been writing books and traveling the globe, trying to sell the world on a different way of producing food. His Polyface Farm, often celebrated in other people's books and films. No exaggeration to say international attention is now following his philosophy. A philosophy perhaps best summed up in his most recent tome, Folks, This Ain't Normal, A Farmer's Advice for Happier Hens, Healthier People, and a Better World. If you've ever run into even some of Joel Salatin's views, you know it's impossible to hear him without reaction. But as this Virginia organic farmer himself is fond of saying,
feel free to interrupt, ask questions, whatever. No topic is off limits.
And since Joel is this hour's sole guest, your chance to react to anything about the Salatin way is coming up right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Worldwide advocate for transforming how human beings produce food and how they live their lives. Author of 8 books with a 9th on the way and co-owner of the Augusta County, Virginia-based Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin is our guest. And if you think you might want to speak with him at any point during this hour, please, right now, note our phone number, 888-967-2825, also known as 888-WMRA-TALK. Joel Salatin, welcome to the Insight Studios.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
I have no idea how we've gotten through almost 8 years of this show on the air, and this is the first time you've been in the studio, but it's so great to see you.
Thank you. Well, it's great to be with you.
Well, I don't think it's too much to say that you, Joel, would like to change the world or at least some key things about the industrialized parts of the world. So I'd like to start by asking you about your top specifics. So can you tell us the things that you would most like to see changed, maybe your top 3 or even your top 5?
Sure. Yeah. If I were a king for a day, you know, sovereign, whatever, the first thing I'd like to change is people's attitudes toward their kitchen. No culture has ever spent more money remodeling and gadgetizing with techno-glitzy infrastructure their kitchen and been more lost as to where it is or used it less frequently. And we've got to get to where people are as passionate about food and their body's fuel as they are about the fuel that goes in their Honda or their Toyota or, you know, the latest belly button piercing in Hollywood celebrity culture. You know, those are important things. Number 2, I think that I would like to see the district attorneys who are quick to hold me accountable if my bull happens to get out and tramp the neighbor's flower beds. To see them hold Monsanto and others accountable for trespassing, bringing their patented life beings in the state of genetically modified organisms across the fence and giving me life forms or beings on my farm that on my property that I don't want to have. I don't get why the kind of right-wing sector, the conservative sector of this country, doesn't understand trespass violations with these GMOs. You know, people are all into, labeling and required labeling, all that stuff. In my opinion, the first time one of Monsanto's life forms came onto my farm and impregnated my plants, they should have been hauled in for trespass violation. It's very simple trespass. You know, it's the old, your fist ends at my nose kind of thing. Number 3, I would allow food freedom of choice. We have a tremendous, food safety inspection service in this country. And, it's amazing to me that the government, which gave us the food pyramid, which, gave us, in 1979, which arguably, stimulated the obesity and type 2 diabetes epidemic by putting, carbohydrates on the bottom of the pyramid, and they didn't differentiate, between Twinkies, Cocoa Puffs, you know, Count Chocula cereal and fresh sprouted amaranth bread. You know, it's just, it's all grains. And of course, the government had gave us a lot of things. You know, they've given us mad cow disease by telling us to feed dead cows to cows for 40 years. They're, you know, pushing irradiated, mandatory irradiation on food, arguably, you know, gave us all of these things, including, you know, herbicides, pesticides, all that stuff. It's amazing to me that so many people want to put food safety in, you know, on the government, that they're the repository of food safety, when look what the officialdom has, you know, announced, including subtherapeutic use of antibiotics and all sorts of things. And so I think that somewhere along the way, there needs to be carved out a place where if I want to come to your farm, look around, smell around, and ask around and do business with you and buy your pickles or your pound cake or, you know, the chicken you butchered in your yard, that there needs to be some place for neighbor-to-neighbor commerce without a bureaucracy between that transaction, similar to the way we'd buy a used car from each other or, you know, something. Finally, I would like to see the food system be viewed as something that integrates with our lives rather than something that segregates from our lives. And that includes things as basic and simple as, for example, backyard chickens who eat kitchen scraps so that the scraps don't have to go to the landfill. It includes, you know, solariums on the south side of all houses so that we could get passive solar in the wintertime and grow mesclun mix, you know, all year long. And it includes living roofs, you know, with some perlite and a little board. You know, you can make a living roof, cut off your air conditioner, and grow food. It includes, you know, on-farm value adding, where on farms we can do processing and tanning and woodworking and these kind of, you know, neighbor-friendly manufacturing kind of things at appropriate scale that used to be done in integrated economies. Today we have such a segregated, specialist-oriented industrial sector that, you know, we put all the hamburger joints all there. You know, we put the over here. We put the people that can afford a 1,200 square foot house over in this section. The people that can afford a 1,500 square foot house in this section, and so we have compartmentalized and broken up our society in the way we live. I mean, a lady a couple weeks ago told me she'd gotten a fine by her homeowners association because there's a prohibition against farming in her homeowners association. And she had the unmitigated gall to put a tomato plant in her flower bed. And so she had to pay a fine because she was farming. You know, she can have rose bushes, but not a tomato plant. And it's this kind of unbelievable disconnect from our ecological umbilical as if, you know, as if food and I don't integrate, and even production doesn't integrate this highly kind of what I call a segregated system. So, you know, those would be my kind of top picks, you know, if I could just wave a wand and change things.
Joel Salatin, my question was, how would you like to see the world changed? And I heard a lot of what you think is wrong, mm-hmm. a little bit of the improvements, like the integration topic,
sure.
that was the last thing mm-hmm. that you mentioned. In your books, there's a lot more specifics. Of course, they compile hundreds, thousands of pages between all eight at this point, of things, many of them very specific about how you think people could live their lives better, not just what we're doing wrong, but
right.
what you think we could be doing right.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping we'll have plenty of time to get into some of that. But I suspect for people to best appreciate where you're coming from, Joel, it would help to know a little bit more about your background personally.
Mm-hmm.
Most of your life, you were being exposed to farming and agriculture not only different from a society where very few people grow up on farms anymore, but growing up on farms where things were done differently where most than most farms are across America today.
Sure.
So talk after you were a few weeks old, born in Ohio, you ended up on a farm in Venezuela.
That's right. My dad had a dream of to have a farm in a developing country. He just saw that as a unfettered, you know, new frontier. And so, you know, after working for a few years as an accountant with an oil company, he was able to save up enough money. He was just a poor Indiana boy, and he was able to save up enough money to purchase a farm. And we started raising chickens. The idea was to have broilers and dairy. And so so we started doing that, and he was extremely successful. You know, took him into the, you know, how the Latin American village square, you know, with all the vendors and the pineapple guy and the banana guy. And so, you know, we went in there just with our stuff and quickly cornered the chicken market because our chickens didn't have subclinical pneumonia. All the indigenous birds just run around in the human feces and everything else, you know, and they've all got this kind of a nasal drip, you know, and of course, there, the way the vendors would sell, I mean, they didn't have refrigeration, right? This was early 1950s. They didn't have refrigeration. So the guys would come to the farmers who had their stalls at the market, and the vendors then would buy. They would, of course, negotiate and dicker. And then, for example, the guy that hawked chickens, for example, hawked chickens, that's kind of a mixed metaphor, isn't it? Through the village, then to the senoras, then you know, starting along about, you know, 9:30 or so, here would, you know, come these vendors who would come and try to sell stuff to the senoras in town, who, you know, if they wanted a chicken for dinner, they bought a live chicken on a pole and, you know, butchered it out back and cooked it for dinner. And they knew, they had enough understanding about food to know that whether a bird like had a bunch of mites and, you know, nasal drip, all right, or if it was really clean. And of course, when Dad captured the market, Dad did not endear him to the local, you know, the local chicken farmers, and they didn't come asking, "Well, Señor Saladin, you know, how do you have this?" They of course thought it was magic or voodoo, or, you know, he's got some, you know, something. So anyway, we in the late 50s, then there was the downside of those countries is they're very unstable, and there was a junta, and Pérez Jiménez, you know, was in power, and anyway got ousted, and we basically lost our farm. It got expropriated, and so we fled the country. As the guerrillas came in the front door, we fled the back door and lost everything, came back to the U.S.
You were 4 years old.
I was 4 years old.
Your father, your parents actually in some ways were early trendsetters in organic farming, but some,
yes,
of that was by necessity because they were only able to buy a fairly small farm in Swope, Virginia, in Augusta County.
Yeah.
That was terribly depleted.
Yes.
And that your father's practices in terms of helping that land regenerate are sort of the basis of where you come from today.
Absolutely. So we settled here in 1961 and bought the poorest, cheapest farm that we could find from North Carolina to Pennsylvania. And the reason that it was cheap was because it was gullies and rocks and poor land. And we actually had consultants in to Dad ask him, you know, how can I make a living on this farm? And the answer was, you know, plant corn, build silos, you know, run cows in the woods and that sort of thing. And from his ecological perspective, he didn't want to do that. And so that really captured this pathway toward composting and perennial grass farming and controlled grazing and all the things that we did to gradually heal that farm.
And there are also some key things in your personal experience as a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, 6-year-old, once you're back in the U.S. growing up on a farm, that I think also are key to your perspective today. So we're going to ask you about that, Joel Saladin, and invite our audience to join in too when we continue on Virginia Insight in just a bit more than 1 minute. After being born in Ohio, Joel Salatin spent the first few years of his life on a 1,000-acre farm his parents had created in the highlands of Venezuela. After the family was forced to flee South America due to early 1960s political unrest, they settled on a small farm in Swope, Virginia. That land today is the centerpiece of the organic operation known as Polyphase Farms, co-owned and operated by Joel and his children. Joel Salatin is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So what I'm hoping to get at here, Joel, is kind of a foundation for your worldview. Tell us a little bit more about what life was like from the age of four on.
Sure. Well, we were on this extremely gullied, eroded, rock pile farm. And I think that out of that, you know, my earliest childhood memories, I can remember, for example, walking the farm and never setting foot on a piece of vegetation. There was that much bare ground. I remember taking a tape measure and one time, and we measured how deep one of the gullies was. It was 16 feet. I remember these large saucer-shaped areas in the fields that were just rocks. Early on, then, we started a massive tree planting program. We planted about 50 acres of trees on these steep, gullied slopes that I've been able to watch over my lifetime, and last summer harvested the first ones and, with our bandsaw mill, milled those logs into lumber from trees that I helped Dad plant when I was 6 years old. That's pretty cool, you know. And those banks are now, you know, the gullies are still there, but they're vegetated, they're building soil, the rocks are not there, and, you know, it is gradually healed up. So I think the thing that has really affected my worldview is two things. One is that ecology is a living organism. I mean, it I don't want to get all mystical and weird here.
Oh,
but
go ahead.
But, you know, it can heal. It's like a scab on your skin. I mean, a scab on the land can heal. And in fact, everything is in transition. In fact, people talk about, oh, once we make a strip mall, that's land lost forever. Oh, no. If everybody walked away from that strip mall tomorrow, in 5 years, there'd be trees in the cracks in the asphalt. There'd be vines growing up. Ecology is just vibrant. It just moves. And in my lifetime, I have watched this armpit farm of the community become, you know, arguably, certainly as good. I don't want to get all, you know, messed up with neighbors or anything, but it is certainly as productive as any farm in the community. And I've watched that transformation.
And it's your view that part of the reason that happened is because your dad decided to do things that no other farmers were doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And those things...
In fact, there was some pushback.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. In fact, there still is a lot of pushback. I mean, I'm considered a bioterrorist by many because, well, you mean you don't vaccinate your cows and you don't put your chickens in a confinement house? Why red-winged blackbirds will come and rub beaks with your chickens out in the pasture and take your diseases to the science-based Tyson chicken houses and threaten the planet's food supply, you know, and that's the way it goes.
But one of your dad's primary views was that land that is almost as arid as what he purchased as this depleted farm can be recovered if you make the effort to let nature heal itself, to let soil build.
Right, exactly. And so we started with the premise that we could rehydrate it, we could rebuild soil. And so we looked at nature as a template, if you will. And nature's template is primarily built around perennials, not annuals. I mean, in nature, nothing plows, right? And so the deep soils that we're actually still mining today with subsidized corn and soybeans out of the Midwest was built over centuries by herbivores and perennials. So nature's template is based on herbivores, on perennials, and on a very tight carbon cycle. You know, nature doesn't ship carbon very far. About the farthest carbon moves in nature is as far as it takes an herbivore to eat a plant here and poop over here, or a bird to eat something here and, you know, land on a tree here and poop, or leaves that, you know, that blow off a tree in the fall. They don't blow miles. They blow a few hundred feet. So nature runs a pretty tight carbon, you know, carbon cycle. And so early on, we began composting. And so one of the first machines we bought was not a corn planter or, you know, a fertilizer spreader. It was a chipper so that we could take, you know, poor, you know, poor trees, diseased trees, crooked trees, and work from branches in the woods, chip them, and use that as a carbon source for large-scale composting. And so we have been fiends on carbon. I mean, when Stanton chipped their Christmas trees for years, you know, we would go in with our truck and let them blow the chips in our truck and bring them home. Today, we still pay the, you know, the Esplundi tree expert, you know, the guys that are chipping trees along the road, we pay them to come and dump at the farm. You know, the fact that 80% of all landfill material is carbon, decomposable, is almost an immoral travesty against the ecology's profit and loss statement, which runs on real-time solar energy into biomass that is supposed to decompose on the soil and feed the worms and all that.
I understand this question is going to be a little bit like asking you who's your favorite child. But of your 8 books, I've gotten the impression from you, Joel, that one of your favorites certainly is the one published in 2010 called The Sheer Ecstasy of Being a Lunatic Farmer.
Yeah, it
There's
really
something
is.
Something in that book, in maybe the first or second chapter, around page 19, we were looking at before we turned the microphones on, where you talk about an almost mystical experience in some land owned by the University of Nebraska. Could you read those few paragraphs
sure.
from this book for us, please?
Several years ago, I had the privilege of speaking at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. The college there maintains an acre of native prairie. I walked over into it, and it had a profound effect on me, a veritable religious experience. If ever I walked on holy ground, that was it. Similar to the redwood forest in California, but more powerful for me, surrounded by 8-foot-tall grass with stems as thick as your thumb, I was overwhelmed with a sense of smallness, insignificance. Just a few feet into the field, I was completely lost to the outside world. Towering over me, these blades and seed heads of grass blocked out every distant reference. When Laura Ingalls Wilder recalled in her books how afraid Pa and Ma were that the girls would be lost in this vast sea of fronds, I could easily imagine that parental terror. Anything could creep up on you. Were it not for the paths through this little field about the size of a football field, you could literally go 20 yards in and not find your way out. As I thrilled to the rustling of that mighty grass sea, I closed my eyes and imagined a herd of 3 million bison, undulating in waves, chomping, stomping, butting, cavorting, jockeying, eating, 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 pooping, pooping, pooping. It reminded me that for all of our plowing, fertilizing, machinery, and farm energy, modern American farming still does not produce the amount of meat that was produced here a few centuries ago. Most of that meat was consumed by wolves or destroyed in incredibly inefficient hunting techniques by native peoples. Native Americans would light fires to stampede a herd off a cliff. Imagine how high a cliff would have to be for a buffalo to actually be killed tumbling off it. These are tough critters, and they can take a lot of rough and tumble. Lots more than professional wrestlers. So many would die that the cliff edge would fill up with dead bison until the last of the herd just ran out over the accumulated dead carcasses. Corn and petroleum fertilizer can never, ever compete with the production of the native prairie. Imagine my beloved Shenandoah Valley covered with that kind of grass. The vast Midwest, even Colorado and California. One of our apprentices 20 years ago said that his grandmother told him stories about traveling up through the state of Sonora, Mexico, when she was a little girl. From a moneyed family, she attended boarding school in British Columbia in the early part of the 20th century. All up through Arizona, she said you couldn't see the landscape due to the tall grass growing up along the edge of the road. Today, when you enter that land from Douglas, Arizona, down through Agua Prieta and through Sonora, grass doesn't exist. It's barren, eroding, and desertifying. Raw, open soil baking in the sun.
Joel Salatin reading from his book, The Sheer Ecstasy of Being a Lunatic Farmer. Joel, the grass that you're talking about there, and you mentioned this in some of your other books as well, that's 8 feet tall, the stalks at least as thick as your thumb. That's what you see as natural. That's what used to cover this continent.
Absolutely.
And you think that the fact that most people today, when you say grass, sure. think about that short little stuff that
lawn.
They call a lawn, shows how far we've come right. in understanding what is natural?
Yes, it does. And of course, lest we miss it, remember that landscape of tall prairie, of tall grass, which included the Shenandoah Valley here, was not natural. It was Native American made. It was made by fire. There weren't any fire departments. Native Americans consistently lit fire for a lot of reasons, but it was a manicured silvopasture, a savanna. In fact, the very first European generals who landed on the shores of the New World said they could take an entire European continental army and go anywhere east of the Mississippi without a road. It was huge trees with these tall perennials, and that was what generated the deep soils that America has found its wealth on for all these years, is these deep soils that were created by this tight carbon cycle with the herbivore and the natural and the grass.
Joel Salatin's most recent book is titled Folks, This Ain't Normal, A Farmer's Advice for Happier Hens, Healthier People, and a Better World. Like many of his previous writings, it goes far beyond advocating for different ways of producing food, touching on child rearing, video games, healthcare, ecology, and even excessive packaging of airline food, just to name a few. So if you'd like to talk to him about any of that, or have a question that you'd like to ask him, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Let's go next to Fredericksburg. Pam, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
My question for Joel is, I hear him talking about healing the land and the fact that everything in the ecosystem is constantly in transition. I've seen him do some work where it's not just healing the land, but he's also been pretty significant in healing people. I know, Joel, that you posted groups that live and have done things with Marine Corps Wounded Warriors through the support of GoFarmU.com's mission of nourishing mind, body, and spirit in order to heal veterans as they heal the land through regenerative farming. One of the biggest issues that I've seen, though, through the veterans and others, is that the policies of the government that are making it difficult, if not impossible, for beginning farmers, veterans, and otherwise, in order to be able to make a go of it. What type of policies or things do you think that we can do at a local and a state level to help at least, remove hindrances from those, veterans and their farmers and those that are working through GoFarmU and other programs? How do we help them be successful?
That's a great question, Pam. I think that one of the main ways that we can encourage farmers to be successful is to unleash the entrepreneurial spirit that's alive and well in the countryside. Too many times, when a farmer starts down an entrepreneurial path, whether it's to put in a commercial kitchen or butcher some chickens or make some children's wooden toys or host birthday parties on his farm or do farm to table dinners, things like that, farmers run amiss with local zoning boards and health departments, food safety, things like that. And we desperately need a way for farmers to be able to integrate their farms into the greater commercial activity of the community.
Does that answer your question, Pat?
That does a phenomenal amount and answer your question. I guess the question is what type of specific policies can we encourage our legislators and, those that are in Senate ag committees and things like that then to embrace, because a lot of them are farmers themselves, but they haven't had to purchase the land, in the recent time frame where it's difficult to even make enough to afford the land.
Right. Well, I mean, there are issues, coming up right now. Commissioner Matt Lohr has convened an on-farm activities working group.
This is Virginia's agriculture.
Virginia's, yes, yes.
Actually from the Valley.
Yes, he is, from right here in Harrisonburg. And um, It's about a dozen people on this working group to try to look at these kinds of issues. It's fascinating to me that the wine growers about 15 years ago created special abilities for them to be able to direct market on farms, to be able to entertain people, to have weddings and things, you know, by right on farms. But if you don't grow wine, you don't have that right. And that's quite an amazing thing. So this is a working group that's been convened to see if we can come up with a piece of legislation that that everybody can get behind and carve out some additional participatory commercial activities for farms rather than simply being required to be raw commodities producers for value adding by the industry somewhere else. Again, a segregated system as opposed to integrated system. And so this is an exciting thing, and it certainly is a policy whose time has come.
Pam, thanks so much for your call. Hope that helps. Here on Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight, we have this post from Carolyn who says, "This is the way to go. Does Chipotle in Charlottesville still use Polyface Farm pork? What about any other restaurants? Do they use Joel products? If so, I want to support them."
Well, you're talking my kind of language, because ultimately, we heal the land one bite at a time based on our patronage of food dollars, how we put our spend our food dollars. And I'm not saying you can never have a Coke or a Snickers bar or whatever. I am saying, though, that at the end of the week, what kind of food system have we supported by our food dollars? So I'm with you. Yes, we do still supply the Charlottesville Chipotle, all their pork, and the Harrisonburg Chipotle, all their pork. Only two. That's all we can handle right now. But anyway, we do supply the two. And that has been a long long process, but it's been a great thing. We supply numerous restaurants in the Charlottesville and Harrisonburg and Washington, D.C. area. And rather than, you know, naming them all, I would just encourage you to go on our website, polyfacefarms.com, and click on the taste tab there. And you'll see a listing of all the restaurants that currently carry our products. There's, I think, close to 50 there that we supply.
Carolyn, thanks for that question on our Facebook page. Organic farmer, advocate for radical change of societal norms, and author of 8 books so far, Joel Salatin is our guest. And if you have a question for him, you can post on our Facebook page. We're listed there as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Or give us a call at 888-967-2825. You talked, Joel, about the situation with Chipotle being a long, challenging process. We're going to hit the break here soon. But from what I recall reading about this challenge, part of this gets back to this whole segregation versus integration thing. Certain restaurants often only want certain cuts of meat, and that raises challenges for small farmers?
Well, sure it does, because when you're in a direct marketing farm, you don't have a big warehouse of things. So we've got, at the end of the day, we have to move the whole animal or the whole tomato or, you know, blemished apples as well as perfect apples. And so a farm like us that is actually integrating into the commerce has to have multiple venues of sale in order to use all the product.
We'll try to follow up on that. Also want to let Geneva in Stanton know that she's going to be our next call when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute. Joel Salatin is the author of 8 books, with a 9th on the way. Among his more recent titles, The Sheer Ecstasy of Being a Lunatic Farmer, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal, and Folks, This Ain't Normal. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Next to Stanton, Geneva, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for Joel, please.
Thanks for having me. You had mentioned earlier in Folks This Ain't Normal that there's many themes that are running throughout his book. We lived in Harrisonburg for 8 years and have been customers and fans of Joel's and his family's for a long time, and moved to Fauquier County recently in this past year, and thought we were going to buy some land and have our own little homestead up there. And then this past Christmas, my sister-in-law bought me Folks This Ain't Normal for Christmas, and one of the themes that kept touching my heart as I read through that book was how blessed Joel and his family was for living on that land with four generations of his family. And it just kept coming back to me, and we kind of very suddenly, after some prayer and conversation with my husband, decided to move back to the valley and are building a house. His family, his parents, my husband's parents, have a 20-acre small farmette on the north side of Stanton, and we're now joining the family team, and I'm so grateful that my children and their grandparents get to be with each other, and I just wanted Joel to know how much I appreciate that aspect of his most recent book.
Thank you. I don't think anything fires up my heart more than when somebody comes up. I do a lot of conference speaking and traveling. When somebody says, you know, our family's farming today because you were the only voice that said we can actually do this. You know, most people farm. You know, that there ain't no money in farming, you know, it's dirty and right. dusty and all this. And so to have that voice that says, yes, you can do it. It's just wonderful. And I get all teary when families come up and say, you know, you encouraged us enough and gave us enough, you know, emotional and spiritual and physical, you know, with enough information that we felt like, you know what, this is doable. And that's very gratifying. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Jennifer, thanks for your call. Full title of the book that Jennifer was just mentioning, Folks, This Ain't Normal, A Farmer's Advice for Happier Hens, Healthier People, and a Better World. But I got to tell you, Joel, the first part of that title, Folks, This Ain't Normal, seems to sum up much of what occurs throughout the book, because I got the sense that you were doing an awful lot of complaining about how things are going in the world today, including child rearing, and comparing what you experienced growing up on a farm and what your two children have experienced growing up on your farm to the norm in society today. Tell us what's wrong with how kids are growing up today.
Well, I think it's profound that we're the first culture in human history that views children as a liability instead of an asset. I mean, are we really so uncreative that we can't figure out how children can be an asset instead
of a liability? Tell me what you mean by that, though, liability.
Well, so you know, children, I mean, think about historically children, you wanted children to help pull weeds into beans to keep the firewood, you know, filled up, to help churn the butter, milk the cow, tote the hay, clean out the horse stalls, whatever. There was a lot of simply important work, just functional living work that needed to be done. And what that does, that's why I'm such an advocate for children's gardens, for example, is because there's something that happens when you put that seed in the ground and it germinates, and here comes this tomato plant, and then, you know, 6 weeks later, you're sitting there with this, you know, wonderful red juicy tomato, you know, not the cardboard kind get down at the grocery store, but, you know, the juicy running all down your elbow. There's a miracle there. There's a visceral participation with ecology and life, you know. And when we talk about self-actualizing people, I would suggest that it's far more self-actualizing, self-empowering to participate in this ecological thing of, say, you know, planting a garden and watching, you know, plants grow, than it is to be the top points getter on Angry Birds, for example.
You really don't like to see children playing video games, let alone teenagers.
Yeah, you know, I don't mind it a little bit, but it's kind of like I heard a great business speaker at a business conference recently say, if you're in business and you're not on Twitter, you're making a big mistake. And if you're in business and you're on Twitter all the time, you're making a bigger mistake. Yeah, look, I wouldn't ban video games necessarily, but I do think that we should take that lawn And we should take, even if it's a 10 by 12 area, and have and participate with ecology, have a visceral participation. And it goes even beyond, you know, social and emotional and spiritual. It goes even to the fact that that gentle assaults like splinters and blisters and things like that, literally dirt under their fingernails. How many people remember grandma saying every child should eat a pound of dirt, you know, before they're 12 years old? We now know that that actually helps our immune system to be stronger. And one of the you know, there are now many, you know, doctors that have signed on to the, you know, to this theory that in a culture that is fixated on antimicrobials and not getting dirty, we're actually creating lethargic immune systems that aren't being exercised. And
because children are not exposed to the kinds of things they used to be exposed to.
Exactly.
The germs and the microbes, they build up an immune system.
Exactly. They live in too sanitary an environment.
Joel, it certainly is true to say that you did not grow up in urban America. You didn't grow up in suburban America. As a matter of fact, you didn't even grow up on what has become a traditional American farming portion of America.
That's sure.
Do you have any appreciation for the fact that the millions, hundreds of millions of people in America who did not have your experience at seeing the wonders of nature on a daily basis firsthand, of having parents who were rebuilding almost destroyed land, that it would be natural for them to not see the world the way that you do?
No question. Absolutely. And for sure, just because a child has chores to do does not mean they grow up as good stewards of the landscape. Goodness, human civilization has been destroying the landscape for a long time. That didn't just come with, you know, with industrial agriculture.
But you object
or anything else
to all of the packaging in the world today. You object to the wasted use of energy, of petroleum, of plastics, of watching television, of letting children spend hours and hours on games or on computers or online. And I sense that part of the reason that you object to all that is that you didn't have a basis for that kind of evolution in your life, doing what you were doing as a child growing up and watching your children doing what they were doing growing up on an organic farm.
Well, certainly we could suggest that my experience is extreme, and perhaps it's the extreme that creates, you know, usually it's the extreme that creates the awareness, let's say, and I'll admit guilty, you know, guilty as charged. What concerns me is the lack of appreciation and understanding among people for something as basic as food, and that we can actually, the notion that we could actually en masse as a culture subcontract out all of this ecological participation to a nameless, fameless industrial entity and think that we can still make wise decisions ecologically. You know, Richard Leaves speaks about this with, you know, not the last child left in the woods, and he developed the ecology deficit disorder, whatever it is, you know, that phrase, I'm probably butchering it, but anyway, you get the idea. And that there is something indeed human. There is something human. Human comes from humus. There's something human about participating in ecology. I mean, we have a lot of people today who actually think that the best way to interact with ecology is to never interact with ecology. You know, this, what I call environmentalism by abandonment. The only way that we can be ecologically sensitive is to create a wilderness area or a state park or a national park, and we need to get the people out of it. And one of the things that I've seen on our farm as we have watched the land heal and soil build and the rocks get covered up and trees grow and this is that we humans can participate as a lover to the earth, or as a pillaging rapist. And so I look in the mirror and say, so why do I have this big brain and these opposing thumbs? You know, why do I have that? Is it so that I can inherently destroy faster than any other animal or any other being? Or is it so that I can massage the earth into being more a more abundant object lesson of provision and sufficiency and grace than it would in a static state? And I submit that it is that participatory element in the ecology, whether it's a tomato plant in a pot on a patio, or whether it is a 100,000 acre ranch. We need to realize if we're not healing, we're not going the right direction. We shouldn't be wearing out farms. We shouldn't be wearing out land. We should be healing. We should be creating more abundance rather than less abundance.
Organic farmer Joel Salatin, religion has long been important to you. You, for your undergraduate degree in English, you went to the Conservative Christian College, Bob Jones University in South Carolina. And for a few years after that, you used that degree to work as a reporter at a daily newspaper in Stanton before you went back to your first love of farming. How does your religion connect with the beliefs that you've been sharing with us?
Well, I think that essentially creation is an object lesson of spiritual truth. We're familiar with object lessons, you know. A lot of churches have little object lessons for kiddies. You know, they come down in the front and somebody will bring in a nail or a board, or, you know, and you extract this spiritual truth out of this thing. And so when I look at nature, at the physical world that we see, my question is, how do I make this, and in my case, our farm, how do I make it express spiritual truth? How do I make a forgiving farm? That, for example, is what drives our pond building scheme. You know, we have built all these ponds up in the mountain. We have, you know, 5 miles of plastic pipe carrying water, gravity fed down into the fields to water the farm, so that if the power goes off or we have a drought, we've still got millions and millions of gallons up high in the mountain coming down. That took a lot of money to do that. It took a lot of effort and time, but that is fundamentally an ability to build forgiveness, so that when we have a flood, we catch it and it doesn't affect the neighbors downstream as much. And when we have a drought, we're able to dispense it gently and keep all the springs flowing downstream for the neighbors. That's what I call resiliency or forgiveness, building that into the landscape. And so I want people to come to the farm and look at it and say, wow, this is not a farm of scarcity, a farm of hard scrabble dominion over this land that I've got to wrestle and wrest something from an enemy, you know, that doesn't want. No, it's a lover, and I'm caressing this earth with care and creativity to coax from it a greater abundance and a greater sense of sufficiency. That's as basic as I can go. But then, you know, you say, well, how do you make a forgiving farm? A forgiving farm, for example, should be one in which our animals are more immune all the time. A farm that's using drugs all the time because the animals are sick, that's not a forgiving farm. You know, so it has tremendous ramifications. The way you view the landscape and the way you view the ecology from a Judeo-Christian ethic.
I have so many follow-up questions. We've got 30 seconds left. You choose. What is it that you'd like someone listening to do or to take away from this conversation?
The only thing that I can, you know, with in such short time, I would say is enjoy your kitchen. You know, turn off the TV and go for a treasure hunt of farms in your community that provide integrity food, that build soil, and that build forgiving food systems, and begin to participate in those treasures. They're all over our area, certainly in the Shenandoah Valley.
One of the things I love in your books when you keep talking about getting back into the kitchen is encouraging people to not be afraid to make mistakes.
That's right. That's right. You know, if it's worth, we've all heard if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. That's not true. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly first, because we don't do anything right the first time. So get in your kitchen, get in touch with your food supply, and you know, you'll be able to participate in this wonderful food and farm system.
Our guest has been the author of Folks, This Ain't Normal and 7 other books so far, co-owner of Polyface Farms and worldwide organic farming advocate, Joel Salatin. Joel, it's been such a delight. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you. It's been an honor, Tom.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work that Joel Salatin is doing. Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay, our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. We had extra help today from Susan Comfort. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jusbay and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.